You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 6th of September 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Phil Hahn, and Marcus Hippie.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll set the day's news agenda with Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Oscar, what are the stories we need to know today?
A very brief history of US interventions from Latin America to the Middle East, from 1973 till 2013.
Also on the program, the country kicked out its first democratically elected president in 2012. We'll be in the Maldives to find out if islanders there can get democracy back on track. Also ahead,
I think I'm going to see if I can get the president's attention. Remind him that our planes are being shot at. Remind him that we don't have a fresh policy for Iraq. And remind him that we've got a whole range of options. Not an obsession, a very measured, nuanced approach.
Former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld there will preview a new documentary by Errol Morris, The Unknown Known.
Then we'll visit Toronto to meet an entrepreneur driving around the city in his truck, offering the best local produce from southwestern Ontario, equipped with decades of fine dining experience.
When I was a chef working in restaurants, I did farm-to-table cuisine. So naturally, decided to do local food and bring it to the streets of Toronto.
So all that plus, we'll be checking in with our man in Belgrade, we'll review this morning's British front pages, and we may even play some music as well. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
But first, let's catch up on the headlines with Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. The Syrian civil war is set to dominate day two of the G20 summit in St. Petersburg, with no sign of agreement between hosts Russia and the United States. President Obama favours military action against the Assad regime, but Russia's President Vladimir Putin remains opposed, saying any attack which does not have United Nations approval would be an act of unwarranted aggression. The US ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, says she can't see the Security Council ever reaching agreement.
Our view, again, our considered view, after months of efforts on chemical weapons and after 2.5 years of efforts on Geneva, on the humanitarian situation, is that there is no viable path forward in this Security Council.
The latest documents leaked by the US security whistleblower Edward Snowden suggest that British and US intelligence have cracked the technology used to encrypt internet services such as email, medical records, and banking. The new disclosures allege that the National Security Agency and Britain's GCHQ are hacking online security protocols, with Google and Yahoo among the service providers targeted. The documents, published by the UK's Guardian newspaper in conjunction with the New York Times and ProPublica, say the NSA's $250 million a year top secret program is codenamed Bull Run after the US Civil War battle. Its British counterpart is codenamed Edge Hill, after the opening battle of the English Civil War in the 17th century. French and British investigators are due to announce the details of their inquiry into the gruesome murder of a family in the French Alps last year. Saad al-Hilli, a British man of Iraqi origin, his wife and mother-in-law were killed exactly a year ago, prompting a joint murder investigation between British and French authorities. The family was on a camping holiday in the Annecy region in eastern France when they were shot dead. A French cyclist was also found dead near the scene. Criminology expert Serge Bornstein says this is likely to remain an unsolved murder.
In my long career of expert in forensic psychiatry, I rarely had to study such a violent and irresolute case. But it's not an unseen crime.
Officials in California say the massive wildfire which blackened an area larger than Dallas was caused by a hunter's illegal campfire, which was allowed to burn out of control. Whether the suspected culprit will face criminal charges depends on a variety of factors, including the degree of carelessness or neglect determined by investigators. The Rim Fire, which began on August the 17th in the Stanislaus National Forest west of Yosemite, is the fourth largest in California's history. It's blackened more than 237,000 acres, and firefighting costs have reached $81 million. State officials in Massachusetts and New Hampshire say 13 people who recently underwent neurosurgery may have been exposed to a rare and fatal brain condition similar to mad cow disease in cattle because of a medical device used in both states. On Wednesday, New Hampshire announced 8 patients treated at a hospital in Manchester may have been exposed to Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, or CJD. The Massachusetts Department of Public Health said on Thursday that 5 patients treated at Cape Cod Hospital between June and August are at low risk of infection. The risk of CJD exposure came from a device used on a patient in New Hampshire who was subsequently suspected to have the disease. The day before we learn which city will host the 2020 Olympics, the International Olympic Committee has released a statement from President Jacques Rogge emphasizing the importance of bidders creating a legacy, whether or not they win the Games. Istanbul, Madrid and Tokyo are bidding for the 2020 Olympics. They'll hear their fate in Buenos Aires on Saturday. Rogge has outlined what the winning bid must have.
It will have the corporate world. It will have the representative of social fabric of the city. You will have specialists in urbanism and city development. And all together, they have to define a vision. What is the vision of our city in terms of staging the Olympic Games? What is the legacy we want to leave for future generations? Is it a sustainable legacy?
Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Barney. It is 16:06 in Tokyo, 11:06 in Moscow and 8:06 in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You are indeed listening to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Marcus Hippie. It's time now for us to set the day's news agenda with the 3 big stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Well, joining us here in the studio today on this Friday edition of the program is Oscar Guardiola Rivera of Birkbeck University here in London. Oscar, many thanks for joining us here on the program. Shall we begin, though, with the U.S. and perhaps their role in Latin America when it comes to the Middle East as well?
Oh, thanks very much, Phil. It's a pleasure being here. The agenda today is a brief history of U.S. interventions from Latin America to the Middle East. Next week will mark the 40th anniversary of the U.S. intervention in Latin America, mainly in Brazil and Chile, which culminated in the 11th September 1973 coup that brought General Augusto Pinochet to power in Chile. This week, the body representing Chilean judges has made an unprecedented apology for the actions of its members under military rule since the 1970s. It said that the judiciary at the time had abandoned its role as protector of basic rights and failed in its duty to protect victims of state abuse.
How much of a difference will this apology make?
It will make some difference in the sense that Chile is beginning to recognize at least a sector of Chilean population which had an institution which so far had refused to recognize what had happened during those years is beginning to do so. This apology by the judges comes right after the former president of the Independent Democratic Union, the current kind of inheritor of the former right-wing supporters of Pinochet, Hernán Larraín, also apologized for his party's actions. And as he put it, he's asking for forgiveness is a voice for reconciliation. There is still a long way to go, in spite of the fact that democracy returned to that country after 1988. And we'll see what happens in the coming elections in November. There's an important sector of the youth, of the Chilean youth, which is asking for the constitution to be changed. The constitution was also, is still the one that Pinochet's advisors designed. So this is perhaps the beginning of an important process of reform.
And in a moment, we'll be discussing the U.S.'s relationship with Latin America and perhaps when it comes to intervention or things on that level. But let's talk about this case of Pinochet and what the U.S. knew or what they didn't know and perhaps just how involved they were with him.
Recently, the classified documents have shown that General Pinochet wanted to hold on to power after he lost the referendum on his rule in 1988. Now, the important point here is that the U.S. knew that he would reject the result of the referendum. And, of course, at some point, it although the U.S. had backed Pinochet's rise to power and the coup that brought him to power, it also backed the anti-Pinochet referendum.
So, Oscar, next week indeed will mark the 40th anniversary of the U.S. intervention in Latin America. Do you know how that will be remembered?
It will be remembered as casting a long shadow over current affairs. We will move on very soon to a story that comes from Brazil and has to do with U.S. current intervention in that country. It will be remembered insofar as 1973 was precisely the consequence of the sort of intervention that we keep discussing these days. So surely what is happening now in places like Syria, but also in Brazil, will be remembered in the light of what happened 40 years ago.
Something quite interesting I noticed on the news this morning, watching some of the 20 most powerful leaders there in St. Petersburg for the G20 summit, was the image of Christina Kirchner walking alongside Putin. And you had many of Latin America's leaders towards the front, and many of the European leaders and of course, Barack Obama were behind them, kind of marching almost in two separate groups. That really shows a bit of a divide that is starting to open up, perhaps, between this relationship between Latin America and the Europeans and the Americans, perhaps.
You're absolutely right, Phil. And actually, it is very interesting to see that that such a divide that is beginning to emerge, does remind one of the sort of divides that were characteristic of the 1970s. In fact, today's Le Monde headlines with Cold War as a very important part of today's agenda in the G20. So one has this peculiar feeling of déjà vu, as if the 1970s were still with us.
Moving on to another story, Brazil has cancelled preparations for the visit of President Dilma Rousseff to the United States, and supposedly she is absolutely furious.
She is completely furious, and a Brazilian official said this is a major, major crisis. There needs to be an apology. It needs to be public. Without that, it's basically impossible for her to go to Washington in October. This official was referring to recent revelations that came this week after a Brazilian report by Globo TV provided evidence that the United States NSA had spied on emails, phone calls, and text messages belonging to President Dilma Rousseff.
And it's not just the Brazilians that have been perhaps being peered upon. It is also one of America's strongest allies in the region, of course, is Mexico, their neighbors to the south. Peña Nieto has been spied on by the NSA as well.
Peña Nieto, also Juan Manuel Santos in Colombia, another alleged ally of the United States. I mean, this is sending shockwaves throughout Latin America. But Brazil seems to be the first one to respond in full. Rousseff has said that her country will take punitive action in addition to canceling the visit. This could include a halt on plans to purchase F-18 Super Hornet fighters from Chicago's Boeing company.
Which, of course, is huge news. Do you see them perhaps recalibrating their relationship then, if it's not going to be with the Americans, especially when it comes to military hardware and economics? Have they been turning their focus elsewhere then?
Well, that's absolutely the case. And it highlights a point you already made. You know, Christina Kirchner and some Latin American countries, moving towards Russia, China, that sort of bloc once again. So, yes, witnessing the emerging consequences of U.S. current intervention.
Oscar, shall we move on to your third story?
The final story comes from America's U.S. Democracy Now! News Network. This is Mark Seibel saying, when it came to questions of the efficacy of a U.N. investigation or the number of people killed in the conflict or even the U.S. rendition of what happened, in what order, there are contradictions. He was referring to John Kerry's insistence during this week's Congress hearings that he has irrefutable evidence showing the Assad regime is responsible for the deadly chemical attack. According to him, the claims are full of holes.
That was Oscar Guardiola Rivera setting this day's news agenda.
Many thanks for coming on the program, Oscar, and have a great weekend. Coming up after this very short break, now it may be a honeymoon hotspot, but we'll be finding out why things are getting hot and steamy in the Maldives, and it's all for the wrong reasons.
You've read the magazine, you've listened to the radio, and you've even made it to our new cafe. But now there's more, so much more. Hitting bookshelves this September is Monocle's first book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living. It's a quiet manifesto for doing things well that runs from the macro to the micro. Over 400 pages of fresh editorial, great illustrations, and stunning photography. We look at what makes a great city, how to build a home you'll always love, why it's good to have a Shiba Ken dog by your side, and a cocktail from the Dragonfly Bar in your hand. The Monocle Guide to Better Living will be available in good bookshops around the world and is also available to order now at monocle.com. Happy reading.
And it is 12:15 in Malé, it's 10:15 in Istanbul, and 8:15 here in London. Now, it's been described as one of the most beautiful places on Earth, tiny white sandy atolls surrounded by turquoise clear waters, with some of the most diverse coral reefs on the planet. And with more than 1,000 islands making up the Maldives in the Indian Ocean, it's home to some of the world's most expensive and luxurious hotels. But beyond the five-star hotels, politics has become the hot topic for the country in the aftermath of its recent turmoil.
In 2008, Mohamed Nasheed became the first democratically elected president in more than three decades. Nasheed had brought in a new era of openness and electoral reforms, but in late 2011, protests in the country forced the resignation of Nasheed, many calling it a military coup. So with presidential elections back on the cards, what can we expect for voters? Can Nasheed make it back into power? Joining us now on the line is JJ Robinson, editor of Minivan News in the Maldives. Welcome to the program, JJ. First of all, could you describe us what kind of campaigning have the Maldives seen this far?
Well, the Maldives is an extremely politically polarized country. There's very few people who you could say were swing voters, rather. So the campaigns have been quite intensive, especially given the Nasheed's disappearance of power in on February 7, 2012. So there's lots of flags up. It's generally got quite a carnival atmosphere at the moment in the capital. I'm looking out my window now at a large yellow Mohamed Nasheed balloon floating in the air. There have been some large rallies, large campaigns. Nasheed's held something of a rock concert yesterday. He even was at one stage rapping to attract the youth vote. The other parties have sort of emulated this, so it's been quite a lively place for the last few months.
And when Nasheed came to power in 2008 as the country's first democratically elected leader, you know, many were praising his open style of governance. He was quite a charismatic man. As you mentioned, he really pulls in the youth crowd. But other than pulling in those young voters, he really doesn't seem to resonate with the older population, older bits of the population on some of the outlying atolls outside of Malé, the capital. How surprising, though, is it that he's back running another set of elections after this, what he calls a military coup back in 2011-2012? And do you think it's a real possibility then that, JJ, he could perhaps win in this first round of election campaigning?
Many questions there. The first part, you are absolutely right that Nasheed's support and particularly reputation internationally has not necessarily been mirrored locally. A large part of that was that after winning in 2008, Nasheed took a rather magnanimous approach to the former regime and sort of allowed particularly the former 30-year autocrat Gayoom to continue peacefully in Malé, and Gayoom's retirement was brief. And as we've seen in other countries like Egypt, the sort of remnants of a dictatorship don't disappear when you evict the ruler. They're still very much there. And so Nasheed had come in as this almost Obama-like figure with a lot of hopes invested in the new democracy.
Nasheed,
and those were somewhat blocked by the sort of remnants of the old regime, particularly as they had a majority in parliament. So You're right. There is a somewhat dissatisfaction in certain levels with the pace of Nasheed's ability to actually implement the changes he'd promised.
Nasheed has promised already that if he returns to power, he will prosecute those who were behind his removal. What else has been promised?
The manifesto is quite probably the first costed and budgeted manifesto I've seen here. They've actually identified where they're getting the money from and how they're spending it. Usually election promises in the Maldives are very personal. Someone will arrive on an island and say, oh, one person needs a fishing boat, everyone can have a fishing boat, or do you need computers, everyone can have an iPad. That sort of culture of patronage is quite strong. There's a lot of vote buying going on, for instance. It's something of a cultural phenomenon.
JJ, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. But we will, of course, be checking in with you after this weekend's election. So hopefully we'll speak to you next week there from the Maldives. Many thanks. JJ Robinson, editor of Minivan News in the Maldives on the country's upcoming presidential elections this weekend. Donald Rumsfeld is perhaps one of the most divisive figures from the American government in the past quarter century, or even recent memory. Now, as George W. Bush's Secretary of Defense, Rumsfeld was one of the main architects of the 2003 invasion of Iraq. The 81-year-old is now the subject of a documentary by the award-winning filmmaker Errol Morris. The man behind The Fog of War, a widely praised documentary on another former Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, the architect of America's equally controversial war in Vietnam.
The new film is called The Unknown Known, a reference to Rumsfeld's famous quotation that there are known knowns, known unknowns, and unknown unknowns. It's premiered at the 2013 Toronto Film Festival and is being screened at the Venice Film Festival now. Morris bases his film on Rumsfeld's memo, which he sent to colleagues and others in government for the better part of half a century.
A bit earlier, our producer Danny Giacopelli asked Robert Fox, defense editor for London's Evening Standard, what he thought of Rumsfeld the man and his legacy. Before that, though, they watched the trailer for the film.
If Saddam's regime were ousted, we would have a much improved position in the region and elsewhere.
Why the obsession with Iraq and Saddam?
Well, you love that word, obsession. I can see the glow in your face when you say it.
Well, I'm an obsessive person.
Are you? I'm not. I'm cool. Measured. If you look at the range of my memos, there might be 0.1% about Iraq. The reason I was concerned about Iraq is because four-star generals would come to me and say, Mr. Secretary, we have a problem. Our orders are to fly over the northern part of Iraq and the southern part of Iraq on a daily basis with the Brits, and we are getting shot at some moment. Could be tomorrow, could be next month, could be next year. One of our planes is going to be shot down, and our pilots and crews are going to be killed, or they're going to be captured. The question will be, what in the world were we flying those flights for? What was the cost-benefit ratio? What was our country gaining? So you sit down and you say, I think I'm going to see if I can get the president's attention. Remind him that our planes are being shot at. Remind him that we don't have a fresh policy for Iraq. And remind him that we've got a whole range of options. Not an obsession, a very measured, nuanced approach, I think.
What are your initial impressions to that? For those who can't see the trailer, Rumsfeld smiles as he says the words, I think. What are your initial impressions?
It's Jack Nicholson, isn't it, doing one of his really goofy numbers. This is a man who is not truly in touch with reality. He thinks he's in touch with himself. These formulae that he mentioned, actually, he sold it to a head of government, but it was not the head of his government. It was sold to Tony Blair. Tony Blair became the visionary who said, we could get rid of this and we would have a much improved position. Which, curiously, there's nothing new under the sun. It is very, very old, that view, that you could clean out Saddam, make a model democracy right in the middle of the Middle East and resolve it. It comes up in one of Errol Morris's other great documentaries, his interview with Secretary of Defense McNamara, responsible for the bombing the Vietnamese back to the Stone Age under Lyndon B. Johnson, who actually had a pentimento, a reflection. And what he said, and it's very, very sad that somebody at the end of this career and the end of all those hundreds of thousands and possibly millions of deaths could talk about, well, I guess you should empathize, you should understand your enemy. This man, Rumsfeld, has no understanding of his enemy absolutely whatsoever. And he has very little understanding of the environment of many, many of his friends.
So the movie you're talking about, The Fog of War, as you said, that was another Morris film, 2003. Robert McNamara, widely seen as the architect of the Vietnam War. I mean, as you said, he was contrite. He was reflective. In this trailer, at least, and we haven't seen the film yet, I mean, there seems to be zero reflection on Rumsfeld's part, especially since right now Iraq is seeing the worst violence it's seen since 2008. Do you think he's seeing this and he's kind of in denial, or is he just not kind of absorbing the facts around him at the moment?
What Rumsfeld and his, first of all, his protege, in an earlier incarnation, and now his mentor and senior friend, Dick Cheney, did, was to drag their administration, which really just turned into a regime under their direction, the administration of George W. Bush, who had a very wandering attention span, to put it politely, by the nose. They cooked up Iraq. They were going to do it anyway, because that was in the literature. You can see it in the Project for the New American Century. You can see it in the AEI, the American Enterprise Institute. This was going to be the bellwether thing, that how you were going to democratize the world, you were going to resolve the Middle East, particularly through this regime change. They were set on it from the first. This is absolutely so. And what we're hearing, by the way, in the leaks from the Chilcot Inquiry, this will come out here. And more or less, Blair was signed up to it, but wouldn't tell his people about it. It's not a conspiracy theory. It is a bullheaded way of going about government. Everybody else was soft. Everybody else was pathetic. Rumsfeld scandalously bypassed a lot of his generals, and he got a guy that he knew he could cajole, corral, and even bully in the then commander of CENTCOM, Tommy Franks. And he started micromanaging it, saying it's going to be shock and awe, you can do it with forces light. And then 9/11 came along. He and Cheney thought that was the opportunity for Iraq right away. And although operations took place in Afghanistan and the ousting of the Taliban and so forth and letting the big enemy, Osama bin Laden, flee, it was clear even by the April of 2002, the real one was going to be Iraq. Blair, that month, absolutely signed up, and long before he told anybody else, he'd consigned a British division, which then turned into 40,000 military personnel, to the operation. What is so interesting is how unconstitutionally Cheney and Rumsfeld behaved. And the disaster of Iraq, which reverberates through the region to this day, and it is actually one of the footnotes of absurdity to the position that Obama and Kerry now find, and Hagel, but it's really Obama and Kerry now find themselves in, was that they decided on regime change, only they weren't going to tell anybody about it. And they probably split the Western world with it. You cannot decide to act unilaterally to put things together, because the point that you came to, and one of the justifications I heard from a senior British general at the time was, oh, you've got to go and clear these people out because otherwise it will become a haven for terrorism. Where is the biggest battleground by al-Qaeda and its affiliates at the moment? Iraq. And it is being run by the al-Nusra Front and the Project for Islam in Syria and Iraq. And there's a huge battle for this going on in the chaos. And that's more or less what Rumsfeld and Cheney left behind, and Franks, the chaos of Iraq.
I mean, after Rumsfeld, the defense secretary since him, Gates, Leon Panetta, and now Chuck Hagel, they don't seem to have as much of a strong kind of personality as Rumsfeld. I mean, when
I wouldn't say that. No? I really wouldn't say that. Well, it's like, you know, that look at the recent presidents. The one that's going to be revised upward and upward is George H.W. Bush. Mm. because he was a sensible guy. He was a transactional president.
He's a pragmatist and a realist.
And by the way, and he's the last president to have really experienced combat and knew what it all meant. This is the thing that, which is the legacy of Rumsfeld, alas, the youngest defense secretary in U.S. history and the oldest defense secretary in U.S. history, is that they're so detached from what they deal with. Contrast him with now the man who is in the most difficult position in the U.S. is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Martin Dempsey. Martin Dempsey is absolutely goes by the maxim of the journalist, the lawyer, the good soldier, when in doubt, leave it out. There are too many moving parts in this. And that's what he said when he wrote to the senators in July, the famous July 21st letter. I can't believe that he's changed at all. But what is so appalling with Obama, a thoughtful, deeply intelligent man, but a frightened and worried man intellectually, is that he's picked up the bad legacy of McNamara and Rumsfeld. Wars of American pride. We must show these abstract things which simply don't obtain. And the rest of the world should be saying, no, Syria isn't an issue of American pride. Syria is a colossal, ghastly problem. What you need to know, and Rumsfeld showed himself even worse than McNamara at this, he couldn't do second and third order consequences. And the biggest crime, not only having broken in and kicked the door down, was to impose Paul Bremer as the proconsul of Iraq, which has proved a disaster. And we've had, you know, the whole story out of Downing Street, the famous July memo that they're going to fix the intelligence for the cause of war. That's where Rumsfeld, more than McNamara, Rumsfeld and Cheney, will do stand bad before the jury of history in that they connived at presenting a distortion of the truth. That's where I don't care whether the figures are going up or down in middle America for George W. Bush. It happened on his watch.
And that was Robert Fox, defense editor of the Evening Standard there, speaking with our producer Danny Giacopelli about Rumsfeld and that new film, Unknown Knowns.
In the next half hour of the program, we'll check in with our man in Belgrade, we'll review the British morning newspapers, and we'll meet a man trying to change the stereotype of the typical Canadian cuisine.
We're growing fast. The public seems to be responding to it. Laws are changing. And we're working towards what I consider to be a food truck revolution, a street food revolution.
But before all that, here is Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. The Syrian civil war is set to dominate day two of the G20 summit in St. Petersburg, with no sign of agreement between the hosts, Russia and the United States. President Obama favours military action against the Assad regime, but Russia's President Vladimir Putin remains opposed. Latest documents leaked by the US security whistleblower Edward Snowden suggest that British and US intelligence have cracked the technology used to encrypt internet services such as email, medical records, and banking. French and British investigators are due to announce the details of their inquiry into the murders of a British family in the French Alps last year. Saad al-Hilli, a British man of Iraqi origin, his wife and mother-in-law were killed exactly a year ago. Officials in California say the massive wildfire which blackened an area larger than Dallas was caused by a hunter's illegal campfire which was allowed to burn out of control. The Rim Fire, which began on August the 17th, is the fourth largest fire in California's history. State officials in Massachusetts and New Hampshire say 13 people who recently underwent neurosurgery may have been exposed to a rare and fatal brain condition similar to mad cow disease in cattle because of a medical device used in both states. The day before we learn whether Istanbul, Madrid or Tokyo will host the 2020 Olympics, the International Olympic Committee has released a statement from President Jacques Rogge emphasising the importance of bidders creating a legacy, whether or not they win the right to host the Games. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Barney. You are back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Marcus Hippie and Phil Hahn. Imagine a typical Canadian dish. Is it something along the lines of poutine, a side of fries, gravy and cheese curds?
Yum, yum. Yum, yum. I'm in heaven.
Well, chef and owner of the localist food truck, Michael Potter, is determined to change that stereotype. Starting this summer, he has been driving around Toronto in his brightly green truck, stocked full of the freshest local produce and his pockets stuffed with 30 years of fine dining experience. He is bringing tasty bites from southwestern Ontario to Toronto's residents.
Monocle's Jason Lee caught up with the roaming chef at Fort York on the city's waterfront for this week's edition of The Menu. They talk about Toronto's food truck revolution and localista's passion for local produce as Michael whipped up some duck cakes for a very lucky passerby.
Well, 30 years I was an executive chef, opened up a number of restaurants, did a lot of fine dining, decided I wanted to do something a little bit different, so I took on food trucks. When I was a chef working in restaurants, I did farm-to-table cuisine. So naturally decided to do local food and bring it to the streets of Toronto. That's the way it all started.
And how's the food truck industry like? Is it a pretty close-knit community or is it very competitive?
Right at this moment, 24 food trucks in Toronto. That's not very many, considering down in the States there's a lot more. Austin has somewhere in the neighborhood of almost 300. Vancouver has 130. So we're growing. We're growing fast. The public seems to be responding to it. Laws are changing. And we're working towards what I consider to be a food truck revolution, a street food revolution.
And because when people think food trucks, they think very casual, they think maybe even unhealthy. What are the contrary going to be like, you think?
I don't think that it's unhealthy. And I think that some of the street food that's out there right now is some very creative people, some very creative food, delicious food, fresh ingredients, and very well prepared and healthy. We don't use preservatives. We don't use any of that kind of stuff. So you're not going to find on our truck, anyways, anything that is pre-made. So you're really getting something that's fresh.
Which brings me to my next question. What happens in the winter when there's no harvest?
Well, that's a good question, because what do you do when there isn't anything around? Well, there are some things on the, you know, they're still out there. There's squash, there's beets, there's potatoes, there's still lamb, there's still beef. Sure, we still have to utilize some things that are imported, and we're not going to be 100% local at that point. But at the same time, with a lot of forethought, you can get your product to run through the winter as well.
And talking about government support, what laws have been changing, and what do you think the impact will be?
Well, right now in Toronto, we have a food truck pilot project. There's five parks on the go for 2 months, 24 trucks. Gives us all 22 slots to be able to put into. Pretty much in any day from Tuesday to Friday, and sometimes in some cases the weekends, you'll find 12 to 16 trucks on the street in different locations.
What's the main difference working in kitchens and working on a food truck?
Food trucks are quite a bit smaller. They're mobile. You have to be a little bit more organized. You carry everything with you. When you run out, you run out. And it's a quicker service. It's quicker, faster.
Could you describe your cuisine? What kind of food do you make?
Well, right now, doing local stuff. Now, we're going to the farms, picking up whatever in season, changing our menu on a daily basis. Food's very eclectic. We do everything from fried chicken to barbecue ribs to we do a banh mi sandwich. Traveling, not really holding onto any borders. Crossing borders a lot and trying to find some, you know, eclectic street food, but using fresh local ingredients.
And what's your favorite dish on the menu currently?
Favorite dish on the menu currently? I did some stuff today. You know, this dish just came up this week. And it's called a barbecue duck cakes, but they come from Grand Valley, which is a tiny little place outside of where we live. The ducks are growing there. We barbecue the ducks and then make them into duck cakes, and we serve it with a corn salsa. And this week we had some fresh chanterelle mushrooms, which are beautiful, you know, foraged from up north in Ontario. That went on top of it. It was super dish.
Great. Sounds lovely. Do you think you'll be able to make some for us today?
Yeah, I think I've got some on the truck. You want to have a barbecue duck cake?
Let's go for it.
So these are the chanterelles, Jason. I know nobody can see them because we're on radio, but they're yellow and they're a wild mushroom. They come out of the woods up in northern Ontario. They've got a really great flavor and they're actually quite prized. So if you find them, if you're out in the woods and you find something that looks like this, first of all, make sure it's a chanterelle. And if you eat it and it's not, good luck to you. You never know what's gonna happen.
How would you describe the flavor profile?
Flavor profile of this dish is a little bit Asian. And sort of a combination of taking North American cuisine and giving it a little bit of an Asian twist to it. So it has things like coriander inside of it. It has a little barbecue sauce and that, green onions and things like that. But the real kicker for it is the corn salsa that we put on the top of it. That's a lot of fun. It's like a corn relish, like my mom used to make. So all three of it go together.
Sounds very summery.
Yeah, right now we're doing a lot of summery stuff, you know. And that's we're sitting at, you know, the end of August. Fall's coming on. Peak harvest season, really. Tomatoes are out, peppers are out. Pretty much everything you want to have is, like, in Ontario is fresh in the market right now. So, you know, for a chef, it's like a heyday, right? It's like we have a great time. Right now we got 12 dishes that are seasonal, and we're rotating them on the street all the time. A lot of it's for experimentation because we've only been around now. It's only been a couple of months, so every time we do a dish, I want to keep testing it out. The only way to get it to make the dish better is to continue to cook it all the time. The more you cook it, the better the dish.
Toronto being a melting pot of so many cultures, do you think that's affected the way or the kind of dishes you make?
I think I look at it a lot. Like when we started looking at dishes we want to make, I mean, typically I love dishes that have ethnic influence. So, I mean, I think we're always going to do that kind of thing.
How would you describe Canadian cuisine? Because when I think of Canadian food, I think of poutine and not much else, to be honest.
Oh, come on, poutine. Poutine. I don't... People ask that a lot. What's Canadian cuisine? You know what a Canadian cuisine is? It's a multicultural cuisine. It's an interpretation. It can be an interpretation of your culture, my culture, a whole bunch of stuff together. But it really comes right down to it. If you want Canadian cuisine, you got to live in the country. Because the way you cook in the country with preserves and with things that are like a good roast chicken, a great grilled steak, a beautiful roast beef. Hey man, mac and cheese. Hey, how much more Canadian can you get than that? This is a barbecued duck cakes with hot corn relish and sautéed chanterelles from Northern Ontario.
And garnish with just a touch of...
Put a little bit of coriander on there, there's a little cilantro. That's also inside the duck cake. So the whole thing kind of like meshes together. I like this dish. I think it's a real little winner, you know?
I notice you're putting a lot of love into the display as well. Like, do you think the visual element is just as important in food truck or like street food?
People eat with their eyes. You know, there's beauty in everything. There's beauty in art. There's beauty in food. First of all, you see it. Then you smell it. Then you taste it. Then you remember it, hopefully, and tell all your friends.
That was Michael Potter there speaking to Monocle's Jason Lee for this week's edition of The Menu, which you can catch tonight at 1900 hours London time. That's 1400 hours if you're listening to us from the East Coast of Canada and the United States. Marcus, I think they left something very important off that list, though.
What is that?
Have you ever heard of beaver tails?
I haven't.
They're not actually the tails of beavers, so okay. Don't worry. They're this Canadian...
You never know.
It's a Canadian pastry where it's like a pastry which is deep fried in oil. So it's like a really crispy pastry, and then you can put loads of things on it like icing sugar, maple syrup, bacon. It's delicious. Maybe you should include that on your program next week.
I think what we should do is that next time when we host this show together, you bring those...
That's
and then we do interviews during the show and eat at the same time.
Well, I think we're hosting Midori House on Monday together. So does that mean I need to bring it in for Monday?
Yes.
Okay, that's my chore for the weekend.
You are listening to Midori House and Phil's got plans for the weekend now. We take a short break now, and after that we speak to our man in Belgrade. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. The time is 8:43 here in London, which means it is 9:43 in Belgrade, where we head now to check in with our correspondent there, Guy Delaunay.
Guy, welcome to the program. Happy Friday. We've got a couple of good stories for us, but before we do, last time we spoke, you had broken something. How are you feeling?
Still snapped, Phil.
Oh, well, speedy recovery.
Thank you very much. Yes, it's broken in two places, but the x-ray says it's getting better. My right arm, for anybody who's interested.
Well, I'm glad you're getting better, Guy. Yeah. That's what's important.
Thank you so much.
Let's move on to the story of Momo Kresnik. He is a Bosnian Serb, which was just released, though.
That's right. Now, this is one of the more notorious defendants at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, Momo Krajisnik. He was basically number two in the Bosnian Serb hierarchy behind Radovan Karadzic. He was really Karadzic's right-hand man. And he was sentenced to 20 years in prison for crimes against humanity. But because of a little quirk, he was spending the last part of his detention in Belmarsh prison in the UK. And under UK laws, you can apply for early early release if you've served a certain proportion of your sentence. He'd served more than two-thirds, and his early release was granted, and he returned home to a hero's welcome in his former stronghold in Bosnia of Palais.
And how do the people actually feel there? Like, was everyone happy for him returning?
Well, it really depends who you are. There were certainly thousands of ethnic Serbs in Palais there waiting to hear him speak. There was a rally in the evening when he arrived, and he talked to them. They were holding up posters, not just of him, but photographs of Radovan Karadzic as well. It's difficult to say how widely spread this sentiment is, of course. You know, the people who turn out for rallies are the ones who want to turn out for the rallies. There's probably an awful lot of ethnic Serbs who'd rather forget the whole thing. And of course, the other ethnicities in Bosnia were distinctly unimpressed. This was a man who was convicted of a joint criminal enterprise for the ethnic cleansing of areas of Bosnia. In other words, forcing any non-ethnic Serbs out of particular areas so that they could be occupied exclusively by ethnic Serbs. And we all know what happened in that process. Although he was actually acquitted of genocide, much to the chagrin of ethnic Croats and Muslims.
And Guy, this is not going to be very good news for any hopes or prospects of achieving a national reconciliation, is it? It's just going to continue this divide.
Well, this is it. I mean, you'd like to think there'd be a big gesture from Momo Krajisnik, something about, you know, to achieve this reconciliation. That hasn't come yet. All he said was when these thousands of people turned up to greet him in Palais, he said, "I don't know why they've come out for me. I'm just a war criminal." That was his attempt at humour. But the problem with the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, the Hague Tribunal, as people call it, is that, you know, it really hasn't achieved the sense of reconciliation that it was hoping to do. A lot of people feel injustice from it rather than any sense of vindication. Injustice when people like Krajisnik are released. The ethnic Serbs feel injustice because nobody really has been convicted of serious crimes against ethnic Serbs, and there were many of those, and the Hague Tribunal hasn't been very good at prosecuting those, so it hasn't achieved this aim of reconciliation that it set out to do.
Guy, local elections are not always that interesting as a topic, but actually local elections, there are approaching in your direction that may actually make a change.
And they will be gripping, Marcus. But these are the local elections in Kosovo. And now the reason this is different, of course, is Kosovo is in effect a divided country. You've got the Albanian ethnic majority in southern Kosovo, and in four provinces in the north, you've got mostly ethnic Serb population who've been refusing to accept government from Pristina, which declared unilaterally independence 5 years ago. And now what's happened in recent months is that there's been a deal between the government of Serbia in Belgrade and the government of the Republic of Kosovo in Pristina to normalize relations. And as part of this, they're trying to encourage these ethnic Serbs in northern Kosovo to vote in the Kosovo local elections in November. Now, if they turn out in reasonable numbers and vote in this election, it'll be a sign of the acceptance of the ethnic Serbs that the Pristina's government does have authority over them, and it'll be a big step forward in this normalization of relations between the two countries.
And Guy, finally, let's move on to football, shall we? We know, of course, you are in Belgrade, so you kind of have to say that you're behind Serbia's bid to beat Croatia.
No such thing. I'm strictly neutral in these matters. I cover all the countries of the region. But, you know, I don't know if Serbia have much chance. They've been playing appallingly in over this World Cup qualification period. This is going to be one of the most bitter football matches in Europe. Serbia against Croatia, only the second time they have ever met as independent nations. And, of course, lots of backstory to this. The earlier match in March in Zagreb, away fans were banned from that, as they are from this leg. But it was very feisty indeed, with chance of killer Serb and that sort of thing. So I think you can expect some usual football supporter-type behaviour in this return leg.
How much do you know about security measures that will be taken during those?
There's going to be 4,000 police around the stadium. Now, bearing in mind there's only 40,000 in the match, so that's one policeman for every 10 supporters. There's also going to be private security guards within the ground as well. So it's going to be very tightly policed indeed. I mean, you know, they've got all this list of things of what you're not meant to bring into the stadium. Things like bottles, cups, cans, the subject of any kind which could be used to cut, stab, blow up, and other forms of harm. You know.
Stay safe.
They're asking people to play nice. But it's at the Red Star Stadium in Belgrade, which is usually the home to some fairly fighty occasions. So brace yourselves.
Indeed. That was Monaco's Man in Belgrade, Guy Delaunay. Thank you very much. Good talking to you.
Now, in just a moment, we'll be joined by our resident Welshman to flip through this morning's British newspapers, Thomas Lewis. But before that, we are going to hear from everyone's favorite Welshman. It, of course, is Tom Jones. And this is What's New, Pussycat?
Be kissing your sweet little pussycat lips. Pussycat, pussycat, I love you. Yes, I do. You and your pussycat lips. You and your pussycat eyes. You and your pussycat nose.
Oh, that is a good song at that. What is New, Pussycat by the legendary Tom Jones.
And it's now time for the British papers, and we're joined in the studio by our own Welshman, Tom Lewis. So, what's new?
What's new, Pussycat, huh?
I thought you were going to say our own Welsh Pussycat, Marcus.
Okay,
there we
let's
are.
Keep it clean, here Thomas. I am. It's very early in the morning.
Ready to go.
Maybe Friday. It's not Friday night yet.
That Friday feeling, Phil. Well, we're starting all the British papers today. Yesterday, on a road into London from the county of Kent, there's huge traffic pileup, and anyone who's seen those images on the rolling news
Amazing.
Or in the papers, extraordinary, aren't they? And nobody, thank goodness, was killed, but over 200 people did suffer injuries, and over 130 cars were involved in this. And the lorry driver, there's one lorry driver who's being hailed as a bit of a hero of the whole event. He saw what was happening. He saw that there was trouble on the road and that these cars were getting in trouble. And he took his lorry and basically cut across all the traffic, blocking off the road so no one else would get involved. And it was a pretty, could have been a pretty hairy thing to do. And he survived unscathed, and so did many more people too.
That's amazing. We need more people like that. Let's move on to a very big news story, obviously, the latest on Syria.
Of course, yes. Every British newspaper has something on their front page about the negotiations in St. Petersburg as the G20 meeting takes place. Now, it's interesting. There's a big debate here in the UK about Syria, obviously. We've covered that story in depth here on Monocle 24. But from a British point of view, the failure of the vote that David Cameron put to Parliament last week is really started a debate here about Britain's place, Britain's influence in the world. And it's a pretty interesting debate, actually. David Cameron obviously came out and said, it's my role as Prime Minister to give Parliament the voice. They represent the British people, as do I, but they had their say and I have to deal with that. Now, many people have said, well, that shows weakness, that shows that maybe British influence is now becoming more irrelevant on the world stage. I think many of the papers do, and I think importantly, pick up on the point, however, that other governments who want to strike Syria in whatever way they decide to do have now taken the same course as he did. So obviously President Obama is putting a vote to Congress on September the 9th. The French had a debate earlier this week. And, you know, there were suggestions before that those governments would just make a decision and go. So I think, you know, you can see that maybe David Cameron failed to put his case to Parliament, but actually it's a template, I think, that many other world leaders see as very important, especially with something like a shadow.
And I guess the important thing is that in the case of the British Parliament, of course, David Cameron didn't succeed in getting what he wanted. And many people are continuing to blame Ed Miliband, the opposition leader, for trying to play politics here and get a couple extra points. But I think the interesting point with the American case is, you know, he is going to Congress, but by all accounts, I know it's not a done deal, but it looks like it's very positive that it will indeed, Congress will authorize.
Absolutely, but you could say that it's a risk for Obama to put something that he believes, obviously, presumably, quite strongly in, to a very split Congress, which throughout his first term as presidency, even the first, say, year or so of his second term, has been pretty divided. And maybe that's something in terms of legacy. Maybe he wants to be able to say, I did try and bridge the divide across the aisle.
Thomas, I don't want to run out of time, therefore I think we should move to another story, which is lighter, about
There are
cinema.
Lights at the end of the tunnel. Yes, cinema. So, Phil, I'm sure you've booked your ticket for this one.
Have you already seen it?
The Princess Diana movie premiered in London last night. I'll be honest, personally, I'll put my personal tone in there. Not that excited about this film, but it is getting a lot of press. And obviously a lot of the papers have reviews of the movie. Marcus, what do you think they said? What do you think the...
I haven't looked at those, but actually I spoke to one of our regulars here on Monocle 24, a native Finn as well, who'd actually gone to press junket, and he'd seen the film and he told me on the phone that it was crap.
Well, let me read you the Times' review. Squirmingly embarrassing, atrocious, intrusive. Really, that's enough said. And it gives it one star.
Do you know what makes it that bad?
Because on the face of it, it's of course a remarkable story, isn't it?
Well, I mean, but
it's just hard to replicate that.
There are many people, say, in Britain or in North America particularly, who still love the Diana story. They still are totally intrigued by it. Obviously, there are lots of people who think there are lots of ambiguity still about the way she died. So obviously, that's what the filmmakers and the producers were hoping to tap into. But it seems from these initial reviews that they've gone the sort of maybe the schmaltz route rather the intrigue route.
And Thomas, of course, it is Friday evening here. It will soon be Friday evening here in London. I know how you like to spend your Friday nights curled up with a nice book, perhaps 50 Shades of Grey.
Yes, you've seen my bookshelf.
I have, yeah, 50 Shades of Grey and Fabio books.
Yes, that's right. So 50 Shades of Grey, obviously there's another movie coming out of that. They announced the cast list of that movie this week.
Lots of people weren't happy with the
Lots of people weren't happy with that, yes. But now there's a little story coming from the charity shops of the UK. And there, apparently, it was a record-selling book, 5 million copies sold in the UK, but most of those copies are now finding their way to second-hand bookstores, charity shops, online book sites. And one bookseller told the Daily Telegraph that nobody wants them anymore, and it's becoming a paper mountain, which is sort of maybe E.L. James, whatever she's called, the author, doesn't really mind, actually. She's cashed those checks and she's more than happy with how they sold. I don't know, have you ever leafed through them, Marcus? Is that something you've, on those cold Scandinavian evenings?
To be honest, actually, I haven't, but I know that there's a website or something that basically lists like the only pages you really need to read if you want to find out what the book is all about.
That was a diligent reader right there.
Well, I guess it's good news for you. You can pick up a couple extra copies. Yeah. So if you're on the bus, you can read it there. If you can, keep one at the office, keep one at the gym.
Absolutely. That's my Christmas present to you now, sorted, Phil.
I'm excited.
So expect in your stocking.
Do you think the upcoming 50 Shades of Grey film is going to be better than Diana film?
Who knows? Maybe. Well, I mean, there is kind of an interesting director. Is it Sam Taylor Wood, I believe, who is a prize-winning artist here? And, so that might be kind of put an more interesting take.
He's married
to
a much younger man, just by an interesting fact.
Thank you very much. That was Tom Lewis with the British Front Pages.
And that's all the time we have for today. Thanks to our producer, Daniel Giacopelli, our researcher, Henrietta Landaus, and Matt Alagaya. And our studio manager was Chris Fitch. Up next, after the news, is Monocle's design program, Section D, with Tom Morris. Midori House will be back at the same time tomorrow with me and Marcus. But from me, Phil Hahn.
And from me, Marcus Hippi.
Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye. Goodbye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.